ISO 400, Episode 123, heute mit einem ganz besonderen Gast, und zwar ISO 400 Goes International, heute mit Alex Munoz, einem großartigen Streetfotografen. Aber erstmal das Intro, ab geht's.
Oh, let's go. Ah. Yeah, like little 90s vibe.
Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Hey, man.
That intro is like got me pumped.
Oh, that's great, because I'm feeling totally the same. We switched intros recently, a few weeks ago, and I heard this one especially, and I was hyped. I knew we have to have this intro.
Yeah, I've been watching. So I really like Karate Kid.
I've been
watching Cobra Kai, the TV series.
That's like this direction.
Every night. Yeah, and I've been watching it every night. And so this sounds like just straight out of Cobra Kai, you know, like Karate Kid, you know.
Perfect. I'm super stoked.
Like a knight in shining armor from a long time ago. Like that.
You know? Oh, man. I'm hyped. Thank you so much. It's a pleasure having you, man, on this podcast. It's basically the first episode where I'm doing in English here. You're the first guest ever in English. And
oh, good.
Yeah, that's perfect. I'm super glad for having you.
Guten Tag.
Guten Tag. Yeah. Yeah. That's perfect. So let's switch to German if you're capable.
nein. I can't.
Perfect. And for everybody who's not aware, you're basically living in Japan, and it's 10 p.m. on your side. So
yeah, it's 10 p.m. here in Tokyo, Japan.
Yeah, and you're giving me those sleepy hours for the podcast.
Oh no, I don't go to sleep until like 12, 1 a.m.
Okay,
I'm a bit of a night owl. I stay up pretty late. And I wake up pretty early, unfortunately. Anyways,
but
because of my kid, I have a 5-year-old kid. So
okay, you don't sound that sleepy. At 10 p.m., I would be done, totally done.
I had a little drink. You know, I had just a little drink, just enough. Okay. To get me loose, so I'm okay.
Perfect. Incredible, yeah. Alex. For anybody who might not know you, could you please give them a little bit of an introduction? I already told them you're a street photographer. You're a famous street photographer, and probably a lot of German people know you through Samuel Streetlife.
Yeah. I think Samuel is obviously... We are kind of like brothers.
Yeah.
Brothers in a sense that like he's half Japanese, half German. Mm-hmm. And when he has to come to Japan, then, you know, we try to link up and we try to make some videos together and we try to do some things. And I've always been supportive of him. When he was first starting his channel, I was one of his first, if not the first, you know, fan of his, always commenting on his videos and telling him to, you know, keep it up and this and that. And we chat back and forth on Instagram and here and there. And, you know, as he got bigger and bigger and everything, it's just, he's exploded. And I've just been fortunate enough to have such a good friend who's much more famous than me at this point with YouTube. Yes.
But I was totally aware of you, Samuel, and Ulysses, basically.
Ulysses is also a really great friend of mine. And cool. We see each other every once in a while. He's quite busy with his own life too, as well. And so am I. So we don't always cross paths, even though we're living in the same city here. Mm-hmm. But we do see each other every once in a while and, try to hook up and, you know, if possible, make a video or I help him or this and that. But, it's nice. The three of us, especially when we made some videos together, a couple years ago at this point. Of course we made the very humorous, Leica, video, or like a photographer's say, or like a photographer's, or like, I forget the title of the video, but we basically just make fun of ourselves even, and other like a photographers and other friends that we know. We just joined in and it was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Sounds great. You're doing YouTube since a long time, right?
Yeah. I've actually, so I think a lot of people think that I've started YouTube maybe around 2020. But the reality is I've been doing YouTube and, you know, struggling to like make it, you know, like to like get some kind of a viewers, you know, on my YouTube channel since like maybe 2017.
Wow.
So, okay. Yeah, you know, because, you know, YouTube is difficult for anyone to get really attention. And I think especially before the pandemic, it was really, there was really not that many photography YouTube channels out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were some, but to actually get attention as a YouTube photography related, especially street photography, it is a little bit more niche. Back then, was quite difficult. So I was making a lot of POV videos of me going out to shoot in Japan and this and that. And then, eventually I decided I'm gonna switch it up and I'm gonna take YouTube more seriously. And I'm gonna, you know, make talking videos and I'm gonna get in front of the camera and mm-hmm. I'm gonna explain things and have fun, you know, in front of the camera, because a lot of the times I was behind the camera and I realized, you know, maybe this is not working out, me being behind the camera and just taking photos and just posting them, and, you know, it's not enough, right? So eventually I started taking it seriously in 2020. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You said street photography was a niche back then. Do you think it's still a niche, or do you think it's more widely approachable?
Oh, it's gotten so big now, I think, street photography. And it's gotten so big that I think really it used to be that as a street photographer, right? Purely on just about the genre of street photographer, not street photography on YouTube, but the genre of street photography, how big has it been, right? It used to be that nobody on the street would know what I'm doing with a camera.
Yeah.
Like, what is this guy doing with a camera on the street taking photos of things and people and situations that, you know, he shouldn't be photographing, quote unquote, right? And it used to be this mysterious thing that people would come up to me and say, hey, what are you doing? And then I have to talk to them. And, you know, I'm trying to document the life on the street. I'm trying to take nice photos, tell a story, or connect with people and these kind of things. But now these days, 2024, I'm out on the street. Immediately, I lift my camera up. You know, somebody will notice me and say, oh, are you taking street photos, street photography? In Japan, they say street snap is what they call street photography. They say street snap, which I don't really like the name snap because it sounds a little bit cheap. But, you know, that's what Japanese people say. Street snap desu ka? Street snap besurin desu ka? I'm like, yeah. I'm taking photos on the street. I'm doing street photography. And then they're like, oh, cool. You know, and like, everybody like will then tell me about some TikTok that they saw. And then I'm like, I'm like, okay. Mm-hmm. All right, great. No, thank you. But, you know, like there's a lot of mediums out there that are kind of spreading street photography. And that's a good thing. It's a good thing overall, in general. It exposes people to the genre. I think it's important.
How do people react in Japan to your art of, to your style of photography, to street photography? Because I'm obviously living in Germany. I'm aware of German law and I'm aware of data protection laws and stuff like that. Are Japanese people more open-minded to street photography, or are they, I would love to keep distance?
It's such, you know, I know in Germany, it's quite, I don't know, what's the word for it? Is it illegal? It's not really illegal.
It's not really illegal, but
it's just how would you say?
Oh, it's really difficult, Alex. You are nobody who's not a lawyer is capable of telling you what are you exactly able to do on the streets. But in Germany, there's this data protection law.
You're
not allowed to take pictures from strangers and do something with them on the internet to release them to Instagram and stuff like that. But if you are not getting sued, everything's fine.
Yeah.
But if you're getting sued, then you've got a problem. So
yeah, of course, And it's a little bit tricky. I think in Germany, it's more on the side of street photography is, you know, it's more a little anti-street photography.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
In Japan, in the US, in Hong Kong, which I just came back from, I think other European countries, or even UK, I feel like it's also in this gray area, but it's leaning more towards freedom of expression and art that is legal, right? And it's the same way in Japan. So to answer your question is how does the society react to street photographers here? Well, like I was saying, I think recently it's a good thing that street photography is a growing genre and becoming more popular because it's exposing people to the fact that what street photographers who are well-intentioned, which is a majority of street photographers I've found, 99.9% of street photographers I've found are very well-intentioned and good people. But the what people have found is that, okay, these street photographers are trying to do something that's nice and artistic and meaningful. But there's, of course, a large portion of the population that would not like their photograph taken, would, you know, prefer not to be photographed. But in general, Japanese people, society here, they're very reserved, non-confrontational, and they won't, if somebody has a problem with you taking their photo, they won't specifically or explicitly tell you, hey, don't take my photo, unless you're really being aggressive about it. Mm-hmm. You know, you really have to be aggressive about it for someone to tell you, hey, don't take my photo.
Did you ever experience such a situation in the past?
Well, you know, like I'm not going to say like I've never made a mistake in who or what or situation I've taken a photograph of someone. But I can only count on my hand, maybe, you know, on one hand, two or three times where it's like, oh, you know what? Yeah, maybe, I shouldn't have taken the photo of that situation. But, you know, I always kind of recognize that if it's true. And I'm speaking so generally right now because I really don't have a situation where it's like, I made a mistake. That I made somebody feel like really, really uncomfortable. I've been living here long enough where I have a good understanding of what is encroaching on people's personal space and what would make people really uncomfortable with me taking a photo of them. And of course, because my intentions are always well, and because I'm trying to tell a story that is always what I'm trying to do is always tell something that's like a positive good story or something that is nice. And I'm never trying to tell bad stories, you know? I'm never, if you know what I mean, I'm never trying to go for these stories that are exploitative, right? Or these people that I feel like I would be exploiting them by taking their photo or posting them online. So I personally haven't had so many issues Yeah. In the last Does that answer your question?
Yeah, totally. In the last year, I visited a street photography workshop in, it was basically in Germany. It was in Nuremberg, which is approximately 2 hour drive away from where I live. And Joe Greer held that workshop. And it was pretty interesting. It was a pretty interesting one. And he said something like, don't be a creep on the streets. Try to take this photograph. It was more likely lean into the American side of view, not especially Germany. But he told us, don't be a creep. Don't try to sneak up on those people and try to get their picture. Be friendly. Be open-minded. Be
right.
And I think, like you explained it, it's basically the same way that you are approaching street photography, right?
Yes, yes. So I totally agree. And so the approach, the manner in which one should approach street photography is from a completely honest, you know, way. And saying, you know, like, look, this is me. I am here. I am present on the street. This is my camera. This is my face. You know, I'm taking this photo and hello, how are you? You know? And
nice. Yeah.
And if you didn't like the photo, then you have a chance to talk to me because I'm here. I'm present. I didn't take a photo and scurry off, you know, walk away quickly or run away this kind of thing, or taking a sneaky kind of photo, which I don't think, if you're taking a sneaky kind of photo, I don't think you're going to be getting a good photo in the first place.
Yeah, I get you.
Because it's really difficult to take a sneaky good photo.
With a 150 really to 600 focal length or something like that.
Yeah. You know, like, yeah, you really got to, you want to take the really good photos, you actually have to be present in with people. You know, and you have to be present around people, and you have to get into this gray zone, you know, physically with people in the society, you know, where you're not encroaching on their personal space, but you're also not like off on the sidelines or off in a corner or in the shadows or in the bushes or something like that. You know what I mean? You really got to get into this distance and workable range where you're telling a good story, but you're also, you know, you're present in front of people.
Really interesting. Yeah. Really nice. Yeah. I would like to roll a little bit back. We drifted into this street photography topic really fast. I would like to ask you, when did you move to Japan? Your name doesn't imply that you're a native Japan person.
Yeah.
I would love to get to know the backstory of it.
Okay, well, it's a bit long. I'm going to try to make it as quick as possible.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I will tell you, I've been back and forth in Japan a few times, and so...
Yeah.
The first time initially I lived in Japan was actually during college, when my father was in the Navy, and then he got stationed from the U.S. To Japan. He got stationed in Japan, and I was in college, and I was just about to move out of the house, and I was in college. I was like 19, turning 20. I think I had just turned 20. Even 20 yet? Yeah, I was 20. And then he got station orders. And I was telling my dad, like, just prior, like, hey, you know, I have a friend. We talked. We're going to get an apartment together. I'm going to move in with my friend. I can't live here anymore. My dad's kind of a hard ass, really conservative guy. And my mother is kind of like high maintenance stress, you know? And I'm like, I can't live here anymore at the house. I got to get out of here, you know? And then my dad like dropped the megaton bomb on me. Like, I got my next orders in Japan.
Crazy.
And I was already trying to learn some Japanese and, you know, interested in the culture and these kind of things. It was around the time that like The Last Samurai had come out and like Kill Bill 1 and 2.
Yeah.
And like some other like really just like cool movies. I mean, just like like Samurai Champloo, the anime series, and Cowboy Bebop, and some of these other animes and shows and stuff like that. And like, I'm not really, like, really big on animes. I'm more big on movies. Like, but I was so into Japan at that point, especially this one game for Sega Dreamcast, Shenmue.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know this game?
Shenmue? I'm aware of. Yeah, totally.
Oh, really? Okay, okay. So in this game, Shenmue, right? He's the main character. He's in Yokosuka, Japan. Yokosuka, which is just outside of Tokyo. It's another area outside of Tokyo. I've been there as well many times, by the way. But in this story, he's actually encountering Navy sailors and like getting in street fights and stuff like that. And so I'm like, my dad told me, like, we're getting orders to Yokosuka, Japan. And my mind like just exploded. I'm like, wait a second. My favorite video game of all time. I'm going to be able to live there.
In that video game. Yeah. Right.
In that video game. And he's like, yes. And I was like, oh my God, I was having a nervous breakdown. And I'm like, okay, great. Let's do it. And then a month or two later, he was like, oh, actually they changed this to Okinawa. And then I'm like, no, Okinawa's so far, a little island away from the mainland, totally away from Tokyo and Yokosuka and all this kind of stuff. And then he got back on the phone and he's like, okay, I got to compromise. We're going to move to Sasebo, Nagasaki. And I'm like, okay, it's on the mainland. It's like still crazy far away from Tokyo. You still got to take a train or an airplane. And, cause Nagasaki is all the way in like the south, west of Japan.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
All the way on the tip. Like the closest you're going to get to China and Korea China and Korea.
Yeah.
So I was already kind of like halfway bummed, but I was also just, okay, let's go to Japan. It's still great. And so, yeah, I lived in Sasebo, Nagasaki from, 2006, 2008. And then I met my wife, I met my girlfriend. First things first. I met my girlfriend. We dated for 2 years, got married after 2 years. Cause I wanted to bring her back to America and I wanted to complete my degree. And she also wanted to, you know, move with me and stuff. Yeah, and it was just the best way. And so we lived and we moved back to California and we completed our degree there. We worked and, you know, and this and that, we traveled a bit. And then when we decided that, you know, it's time to move back to Japan because it's a good idea to raise, our child in Japan, our future child.
Yeah.
Then we decided, you know, that this is the timing. So we moved back to Japan and then, yeah, c'est la vie. I've had my kid, my little boy, 5 years old now. And I've been in Japan now for actually, as of right now, 10 years, total,
insane.
On this. Yeah. So it's been a decade and, that's me.
Sounds great. But when did photography come into your life?
If photography came into my life when I was still in California and I had a Mini Cooper S, you know, like the BMW Coopers, right?
Get you. Yeah.
Yeah. And had the supercharger in it. And it was like the loudest, most fun car. And like, I put an exhaust on it and all these parts that make it just like crazy fast and loud and shit. And it was just, it was so much fun.
Like a go-kart.
Yeah, bro. Oh my God. I honestly should be dead the way I drove that car. Just don't tell my wife. Yeah. Like I had so much fun with that car and I wanted to take cool pictures of my car. Right.
Okay.
So I wanted to take fun, cool pictures of my car and video too. And I made a few videos of my car. And actually, that's how my YouTube channel really started. I was making videos of my car.
That's crazy.
And the same exact account I have my YouTube channel on it. It used to be cars.
Did you delete those?
It used to be. Yeah, I deleted. I think I still have the videos on a hard drive. I still have some videos on the hard drive somewhere. Crazy. But I started out taking photos of my car, and then it evolved into, oh, there's a model over here at a car show who's like standing by cars, and you can take their photo, this model by their car and stuff. And like, then I was taking photos of models. Then I was taking photos of like portraits, and I wanted to get better at doing portraits, right? Mm-hmm. But you know, you got to get a subject, take a portrait of.
Right? Yeah, sure.
So then I learned about street portraits. And I'm like, okay, well, I can just go out on the street and I can just ask somebody randomly.
Did you do that?
of course I did. Yeah. I went out in California, in downtown San Diego, which is a great downtown area to learn street photography, actually. It's very, very underrated downtown in California. To do street photography. So I went up there and I started, you know, just doing street portraits. And I knew about street photography also, candid street photography, documentary street photography, these kind of things. I learned about that kind of stuff as well. And I didn't think I would have the balls to do that kind of thing. So I just stuck to street portraits for a while. But you know, after a while doing the street portraits, for just a couple times I did street portraits. I was like, you know, this is nice, you know, to take and asking somebody for a photo, having a nice moment, having a nice chat and stuff. But it does sometimes, you know, it feels a little bit contrived and it feels a little bit, you know, forced, right? So then I was like, okay, you know, I'm going to try the candid street photography. And so I tried doing that and I did that in downtown San Diego. And that's where I started street photography proper there. It was really a lot of fun, and it then helped my confidence to, when I then went to Japan, I could, you know, have a go at it there eventually as well. It was nice. It was definitely nice.
So I could go on.
Sorry. Yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to ask you mentioned you lived in San Diego, and so you were used to live and photograph in big cities. So, but how did Tokyo change that for you? Was it just even bigger or was it something different in terms of photography?
Photographing in a foreign country, I think the purpose and the meaning and reason behind doing street photography while living in a foreign country expands, right? All of the reasoning and the meaningful kind of reasons you have to do street photography. So I want to connect with people. I want to have conversations more in Japanese. I want to improve my Japanese by having meaningful, real conversations with people. And so street photography is a great key to that, to gaining access to people conversationally, you know, physically, mentally, all this kind of stuff, right? So it's really great, street photography, to be able to just use that tool. You have a camera in your hand and then suddenly you're not just another stranger. You're a stranger with a purpose. You're a stranger with a special thing, interesting thing about you. So this is what I enjoy about street photography in Japan.
Yeah. Sounds great. But back to my question, does it differentiate from America?
Right. Okay, I see. So yes and no. Yes and no. Culturally, I was explaining before, you know, society here, they're more reserved and perhaps a little bit more standoffish towards street photography. Mm-hmm. It really just depends on the people. But
sure.
I think, okay, so comparatively, New York, let's say, for example, New York to Tokyo, right? New York, people really don't care. The really real New Yorkers, not tourists, not even people who have only been living in New York for like a short amount of time, like a year, but like real New Yorkers who come from New York and like they got their own, you know, world and thing going on. Real New Yorkers, you take a photo of them, or you're documenting a situation, construction workers, or mm-hmm, just people crossing the street, some businessman, some kids or whatever, or some, you know, mother with their child even. Now, most of them just don't care because they have been in this city where they're surrounded by people who, you know, let's face it, Americans are very loud and boisterous sometimes and very like, just like kind of in your face emotionally sometimes. Yeah. Where like we're like, I feel New Yorkers are very numb or thick skinned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so a street photographer with a camera taking a photo of them or something around them, it doesn't really faze them. This is not, from my experience photographing there, mm-hmm, it's not a big deal. Okay. Other people might have different experiences than me. I'm not going to disagree with them, but this is my experience comparatively to Tokyo. So yeah, or Tokyo people are going to be a little bit more sensitive. You got to kind of walk the finer line with things like, you know, maybe personal space and these kind of things. Whereas a New Yorker, like, you can shoot a 28 millimeter in New York and get up close, or like 21 millimeter, and you're not going to have an issue. But if you want to shoot like a 21 or a 28 in Tokyo, you got to have some experience. You know, I'm not saying you have to have the experience, but you got to have this experience that you can go and you can catch these moments without also making yourself feel bad for making the other person uncomfortable. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Totally get you.
If you want to still be, you want to still like go home not feeling like a piece of shit.
Yeah.
You know, totally. like you disrespected somebody, you know, and you ruined their day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's a body language and a cultural thing that you just only kind of like sense and learn over time. Like, whereas in New York, like anybody, New York is just a jungle. You just go in there and you start flashing people and shit. People are like, what the fuck off? And you're like, whatever. And you're like, yeah, whatever. And just like, get out of here. And it's like, they forget about you like 10 seconds later. It's no big deal.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. But it's more like a give and take in Japan, right?
Yeah, it is. Okay. Yeah.
Is street photography your only lane in photography you're approaching? Or do you do
no
other stuff? Do you privately do weddings or nature photography or stuff like that? Something we're not able to see on your Instagram, for example.
Yeah. I'm a part or full time photographer, portrait photographer. It depends on the seasons. You know, the seasons are up and down. We're leaving the winter pretty soon here, right? So now I'm gonna pick up big time in the spring here with my portrait photography work here. And so I have a photo shoot on Sunday in a couple days. Cool. And I have a session with some people. I have another at the end of the month too as well. And I don't doubt that by the end of this month I will have done maybe 6-7 shoots. Maybe more. It really depends on when the Sakura come. Cause when the Sakura come, I'm going to get tons of photo shoots, sometimes maybe twice a day, for the duration of the Sakura, which usually lasts like maybe 2-3 weeks tops. And then it'll die down a little bit, but it'll still be busy, and I'll still have photo gigs, portrait shoots. You know, and I've done other genres here and there, experimented. I did sports a few times. That was okay. I didn't really like sports. It was kind of boring. I didn't really get on with it very well. I've done a few weddings and I've done some landscape here and there. We actually, you know, I did the book with Lintaro, with Samuel. So yeah, I'm exploring more of my landscape photography side. Yeah.
How important is it for you to tackle those different areas of photography for your mental health, for not burning out, to prevent from burning out? Or do you say, I could do street any time of the day, I love it, and I need this thing in my life?
Yeah, street photography is definitely something that I have ups and downs with, absolutely. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. During the pandemic, I was just, it was just so difficult sometimes because despite what maybe people see on YouTube, you know, what I show or what other people show, you know, try to show things being very fun and cool and these kind of things. There's a lot of boring times.
Yeah,
the majority of it's really boring, you know, a majority of it's not fun. You know what I mean? And so, there's a lot of ups and downs with street photography here. And I do try to take breaks more or less when I know that I'm just not having fun. But, you know, more often than not, I push myself to get back out there and keep going. And, you know, a new camera or lens doesn't help. It does help when you get some new piece of equipment. Oh, let me try to test this out. Let me try this out. And then that kind of like sparks a different kind of, joy out of the genre. But
is it lasting? I don't think so.
No, of course not. Of course not. Definitely not. It's all about the actual photography itself. And the winter here, I think like most countries, winter is not the most fun season to photograph, right?
Welcome to Germany.
Yeah. I can't imagine Germany is going to be any better than Japan when it comes to photography. You know, everybody bundles up, and especially here in Japan, people, you know, put their masks back on again.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
so I like to photograph people. I like seeing people's faces. I like catching moments and emotions and meaningful stories, right? And sometimes that, you know, requires a full face, you know, tell the story.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And photographing somebody with a mask with their eyes can sometimes be very powerful. It can be very nice too as well, you know? Mm-hmm. And as sometimes you don't want to see their face if you want to have a photo that is a little bit more mysterious and that kind of vibe too as well. But more often than not, I'm very tired of seeing people with masks on. And it's a struggle for sure.
Could you imagine moving with your family to the countryside, for instance, and living a life there without street photography?
Yeah, I know. I've thought about this many times.
Yeah.
Previously, before Tokyo, I lived in Fukuoka. And before that, I lived in Nagasaki. And in Nagasaki, kind of a smaller town there. And you can do photography there. But this is a very small town.
Mm-hmm.
But I think about it sometimes. Like, could I do photography in this very small town where my family's from, where my, you know, parents-in-law live? And I think about it sometimes. Yeah, you know what? I can do it. I can make it work, you know. And I would just switch up my genre. I would switch up my style of photography, right? It's certainly doable. And then of course you get tired of it and say, okay, let me go somewhere else. Let me travel. Let me go to Fukuoka again. Let me go to Tokyo. Let me go to Osaka or something like that. Let me take the train or the airplane. And every once in a while you get that hit, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That adrenaline rush, you know, of a big city. But I don't know. I'm a bit of a city boy, so I don't want to be in Ideally, I don't want to be in a smaller city than Fukuoka City, where I used to live, which is kind of a medium-sized city, maybe about the same size as Hamburg, for example.
This is medium-sized?
Do you think Hamburg? I've never been to Hamburg. My impression is that Hamburg is a medium-sized city, compared to Berlin, of course.
Yeah, compared to Berlin, compared to where I live, it's a big city.
Oh. Where do you live?
I'm the total countryside boy. I live between. I'm not sure if you're aware of those cities. It's between Munich and Stuttgart, and it's a really small village with about 500 people.
It's really small.
It's really small, but yeah. I totally love it. And I was asking you this countryside question because I was I discovered it basically, and I'm not sure if you're aware of him, Craig Mott, a photographer also from Japan. And he's, I already sent you that link via Instagram, and he's doing that countryside stuff. He was traveling through Japan, a 30-day walk in Japan, and he was photographing really cool things. And this was something I absolutely fell in love with. And this is some total other approach to this country. I can't see any people on those photos. So,
oh, really? Really? This is always something that I could do for sure. As long as I can press the shutter on something, you know.
Yeah. It's this important thing that. Just to keep photography in your life. No matter what?
Yes, absolutely. You know, bury me with my Leica, for sure. bury me with my camera.
Yeah, get you. Yeah. Now you mentioned Leica, I would love to talk with you a little bit about gear and, of course, your entry ticket in that specific podcast here, your use of film, especially. So
I
would love to know what's your main camera, what are you shooting with, what's your film digital ratio, what are you carrying every day?
Film digital ratio.
Yeah.
Film, probably 99% film.
Wow.
1% digital at this point. Yeah. And it's been like this for a year and a half now.
Yeah.
And I don't really see that changing anytime soon, especially because of how much film I have on hand in stock.
Yeah.
Like I seriously have enough film to shoot for the next 3 years regularly.
Crazy.
Like, not changing pace. Just, and I will shoot maybe about 10 rolls at least a month. Up to 10 to 20 rolls a month,
which is quite a decent amount.
Yeah. But, and if it's black and white, more, if it's color, a little bit less, because color, I gotta pay for the development.
Mm.
I'll take it to a little shop that I have near where I live. So I'm super lucky. And one of the reasons I can shoot film, I can afford to shoot it, is because I bought most of my film before the prices rose tremendously.
Yeah.
And so all the film, most of the film that I have, I bought pre price hike. So I just made an educated guess. I saw the writing on the wall saying the prices are just going up, up and up and up and up. And I don't buy enough now, I'm never going to be able to buy it later in the future. So,
and you stocked up.
And I stocked up. And then two, I have a shop near where I live where it's basically like $3.50 US dollar, to develop a roll.
That's
and
cheap.
And then they give me, it's very, very cheap. Yeah. Like that, what that's going to be like maybe €3 or €2.50. And I even get points as well. So like every 10 rolls, one is free.
No.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So I have an amazing situation right now. And they give me discounts because they like me. Yeah. They just like me.
Crazy.
So they're just, it's just a great shop. It's a blessing. It's called Nishimura Camera
Alex,
Shop. Just a little mom and pop shop.
Awesome. Yeah. Now you've got to tell me how long it takes till getting your scans back or your negatives.
Oh, so same day.
That's insane, man. That's
same insane. Day, same day, the developing the role.
Wow.
But scanning I develop, I do at home.
Yeah,
I do my own scanning.
What's your setup?
Scanning, I have a Nikon CoolScan V.
Oh, you're my man. I've got the same one.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Hell yeah.
Yeah, it's incredible. Nice. Awesome. Do you have also something for scanning medium format, or is it just your setup for 35?
Yes. Epson X... What is it called? X830, 850, 890 or something like that?
That's
800 something.
Flatbed? Is it flatbed?
Yeah, it's a flatbed.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a flatbed. Yeah. Yeah, it's a flatbed. Yeah. And I use these two units. The one, you know, the Nikon CoolScan V is for 35. And then the Epson I use for 120. And I use these units, which are amazing scanners, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
But I got them for free.
Wow. Wow.
Somebody who follows me and my channel and my Instagram, who lives here in Tokyo, who lives actually not that far away from me.
Yeah.
He messaged me and he's like, "Hey man, I don't shoot film anymore. I'm never gonna shoot film again." He's like in his like 60s or something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he's like, I'm done with film. I'm never gonna go back to it. You know, I'm only digital. And I have these scanners that have just been, you know, sitting in a
collecting
box.
Up.
And
yeah.
Yeah. And so he says, "You want to pick them up?" And I'm like, "Of course." Yeah. So I went and I picked them up.
Such a
not
nice
only
guy.
Was
wow.
Yeah, it was amazing, amazing. Because he could have sold it, you know, online or something like that.
Sure.
He just decided, I'm gonna donate it. I'm gonna give it to he could give it to me.
Cool.
I was using the Plustek 8100 before, which is totally fine as well. Just a bit slower. But then, the Nikon CoolScan V, it's a step up for sure.
Awesome. So, now we've got to nerd the shit out of it. What tool are you using with it? ViewScan, SilverFast, the original, the official
SilverFast.
One? Yeah,
SilverFast. Okay. Yeah, SilverFast. Because before what I was doing with SilverFast was I was just scanning it. And to make a DNG, just to get the DNG.
Mm-hmm.
And then I would take that DNG into Lightroom with Negative Lab Pro.
Gotcha.
And I would convert it there. That way I have a little bit more control over the colors and the workflow. But the problem, as you know, is that the Nikon CoolScan V collects dust and plants that dust, you know, all over the place. So if I'm making the DNG, it doesn't have that dust removal, right?
Okay.
It doesn't do dust removal if you make the DNG. So you got to go in there.
Why don't you make a TIFF? I do not have any issues with dust. I never had.
Don't kill me right now.
Oh my God.
Wait, can you make it? You can make a TIFF?
Yeah.
But
I've got to say, I'm using ViewScan.
Ah, okay. Oh, no. Okay. So with SilverFast, as far as I've experimented, the TIFF is only going to make a positive. It's only going to convert. And you can make, I make the TIFFs. I make TIFFs.
But
if you want a TIFF, it's going to convert and you can do the dust, you know, automatic dust removal and that kind of stuff. And you just work completely in SilverFast itself. And then take it into Lightroom and convert with Negative Lab Pro or this or that. So that's what I've been doing, is I've just been using SilverFast to just do a straight scan conversion all in one go. And the colors, you know, I try to set the profile to the one that is best. And do the dust removal. And then when you get that TIFF, when it spits it out into the folder, I open it up. It looks great. And then, you know, I'll go in and I'll adjust, you know, like the blacks and this and that afterwards as well if I need to. But otherwise, it works fine for me.
Okay. Now I'm telling you what I'm doing. And this is the process the guy told me I got it from, the guy who sold it to me. So I'm going to scan in ViewScan as a TIFF with the highest setting and stuff like that. I'm getting 130 megabytes per file. After that, I'm dropping them because it's a positive, but it's a positive with a slightly shifted color range or something like that. And then I'm going to put them into Photoshop and pulling over some gradation curves. It's more complicated than it sounds more complicated than it actually is. I'm adjusting those gradation curves. And after that, I'm done. And it's incredible. It's incredible. You've got to try it. If you want to, I can send you over some tips. No problem. But it's really cool that you're using the same setup in that case.
Yeah. I would have still been doing camera scanning.
Yeah.
Like I was before, I was using the Essential Film Holder. I was doing camera scanning for a while and that works fine and everything. But then it was like, I'm paying for Lightroom monthly, you know, to then use Negative Lab Pro and I'm not shooting digital at all.
Yeah.
You know, and then I'm like, well, I have this, you know, Silver Fast software I don't have to pay monthly for.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. You know what I mean? Because I'm not shooting digital. Like, and if I am shooting digital, I'm just shooting JPEG. So whatever, you know?
Yeah, sure.
And then when I'm delivering to my clients, I actually work with some agencies that I just send over my digital raw files to my agencies and they handle all the editing for me. And then they send it to the client.
Mm-hmm.
They handle all that on the back end. So I don't even have to edit for my professional work, my client work at all either. So I pretty much like never edit like digital photos anymore, which is nice. So I just stick to Silverfast for my film.
Do you edit your film photography?
Yeah, I mean, like, who doesn't edit? Because, like, you have to, like, inherently, you're scanning, you're editing.
Sure.
You know, like, you're setting a profile.
Yeah.
Like, that's an edit.
Totally.
Like, that's an edit. Like, you set your white balance. That's an edit. Like, you know what I mean? Like, you set, I don't know, your highlights, your, like, that's an edit, right?
Yeah.
So I mean, but I'm not going in like really hard with editing. No, absolutely not. Like I really try to keep the film as, you know, accurate to what I think the manufacturer intends it to look like.
Get you.
You know?
Because
so
many people,
if it's Kodak, yeah.
Yeah, many people are pretty religious about editing film and I wanted to know your side of view.
Yeah, I mean if it's Kodak Gold, I want it to look like Kodak Gold.
Yeah, get you.
You know what I mean? If it's CineStill, I want it to look like CineStill,
obviously.
You know, like Venus Vision 3, you know what I mean? Because I mean, why would you shoot one film stock and then try to make it look like another? I don't know. Just go shoot that film stock like you like more. Like if you like Portra and you're like, I don't know, don't try to change a film to make it look like Portra because I don't think the results are going to be as good as just shooting Portra, right?
Yeah, totally.
With one exception is if you can somehow make any film look like a Fuji Pro 400H, then I will take that because I really love Fuji Pro 400H.
Yeah,
awesome. It's a rest in peace. I still have some in my freezer. I'm saving
35 or medium format.
Both.
Oh, incredible! Yeah. Are you?
I have about
C200.
Yeah. You know what? You know what's crazy is I was in Hong Kong last week.
Yeah,
and a lot of the film shops have original C200.
Not really. Kidding me.
On their shelves.
Oh my God.
On their shelves for a reasonable price. Like €8?
Crazy.
Yeah.
There was a time when I was starting out with film photography. There was a time in our drug shop here. There was C200, originally C200, for €5.90, something like that. And I was.
I love C200. Yeah, it's fantastic.
I only have
one. It's really, really good. Unfortunately, I only ever got to shoot two rolls of it.
Yeah.
But those two rolls, I was like, wow, it's really, really good. And it's sure enough, as soon as I finished that roll, discontinued. And the same thing with Fuji Pro 400H. As soon as I shot a few rolls of Pro 400H, discontinued. This is really, really horrible. But before all of the shelves ran out of stock, I had purchased 10 rolls of it. And with, you know, what the intention of being like, I'm gonna keep these and I'm gonna resell them, to be honest. I was gonna be like, I'm gonna be a reseller, I'm gonna resell these for like four times the price. I was gonna be that guy, kind of a scumbag, to be honest. But actually, then I looked at my photos more of Fuji Pro 400H and I was like, man, this looks really, really good. And I, you know, sure, I'll make, you know, a couple $100 if I sell some of these rolls, right? But I would rather use my favorite film ever for Cuba, which is my dream project. So I going to Cuba and photographing there, I'm Cuban American. Mm-hmm. My whole family, both sides, is Cuban American. I've never been there. And photographing there is one of my, you know, dream projects. And so I've saved, have 12 or 13 rolls in 35 now. And I have like 7 boxes in 120 of, five packs. So yeah. So I have like 70 rolls in 120.
Wow.
And yeah, and about 13 or so in 35.
That's incredible.
So I think that's enough for Cuba.
Yeah, I can totally feel it. C200 was those Fuji greens. For Cuba, it should be awesome. Yeah, looks, it should be incredible.
Yeah, it looks really great. Yeah, I just love how when you take a really warm scene that's already naturally very yellow, and then you shoot it with Pro 400H, the color, the balance just comes out perfect, I think.
Awesome. Really looking forward to it. Really looking forward.
Yeah. So am I. So am I.
Perfect. Perfect. We'll see. Alex, as you told me, 99.8% is shoot on film. Or you're shooting film for 99.8%.
What
makes film photography special for you compared to digital?
Film photography, it's so difficult to talk about this.
The big why, Alex.
Yeah, it's so difficult to talk about this without stepping on digital photographers' toes and making people
feel bad. We do not have to do that. Sure, yeah. We do not have to do it and make them look
it's
smaller.
It's just like,
no, absolutely, you know,
like,
not.
Everybody has to be careful, right? With what you say. Like, I like shooting film because blah, 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 blah. But then certain digital photographers will get offended if you say that film looks better than digital. Like, you like the look more than digital, you know, just saying that. So it's always really kind of, it's too bad because that's what I feel.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I don't want to make any digital photographers feel bad because, look, digital photography has its place. It's extremely convenient, right? It can look amazing too. There's no problem with that. But film photography, how it looks, I think especially with faces, I think the film grain is very flattering to people's faces, especially when it comes to like blemishes or, you know, these kind of slight imperfections on skin, right? So I'm always a photographer who's trying to flatter people on the street. I don't want to make people look bad or, you know, not cool or this and that. So I feel like film makes people's skin look better and the light that hits their skin look better because of the highlights. So this is what I like about film. How it looks. The tactile nature, of course, of using the cartridges and developing. I love the developing process, actually. I love home developing. I love being able to just get these rolls in my dark bag, load it all up physically, being successful. I loaded up everything. I didn't screw up, you know, put it in the tank, you know, mix the chemicals in, the right timing and the right temperature and the right agitation and all of this. And then it comes out nice and beautiful and everything worked out. And if it didn't, then I know what I did wrong to fix it and do it again and learn, you know. So it's a great process. I really enjoy that. And I just got into the printing process now, darkroom printing at home.
Incredible. Okay.
Yeah. With the Intrepid compact enlarger system.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is, I find is fantastic. It's amazing. it's really just so easy to set up and just start using right away. And the results, you know, you're not going to get any different results from a huge enlarger to this Intrepid compact enlarger. So I really recommend it. I think it's awesome. It's just a matter of like what paper you're using and this and that, which is going to change your results and maybe the lens, you know, on the enlarger itself, but you use the same lenses and everything. So anyways, I love darkroom printing, black and white. So digital photography can't do that for me. You can't, you know, go in a dark room and print that digital photo into a chemically reacted, you know, photo on a you know, gelatin paper, you know. You can't do it. There's these newer papers out there that I think you can make a digital photo into a negative that then goes onto the paper, some new kind of high tech situation and stuff, but it's really expensive. Mm-hmm. And from what I understand, it's really expensive and, kind of cumbersome and stuff like that. So, if you're a film photographer already, you have all your negatives and you have everything for the rest of your life, physical.
you have to organize them. And I'm so bad.
You have to organize
them. I'm so bad at doing that. Incredible.
Yeah. Organization. That's a big drawback.
That's a big part. Yeah.
Organization, the space you need.
Sure.
For all, you know, the rolls and the binders and the everything, the chemicals and just everything that you need for it. So much stuff. But it's fun stuff. It's cool stuff.
Getcha.
I enjoy this, you know, I enjoy this stuff. Yeah.
Oh, and I would love to talk about one of your latest projects. I saw on YouTube, it's this little scene you made one day in Coney where you shot some rolls of Lomography 400 with your Leica M2. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah. So, Lomo 400. First of all, I wanted to choose that film because it's very high saturation.
Yeah.
And I feel like not a lot of New York street photographers are shooting Lomo 400. I feel a lot of New York street photographers are using Portra, maybe Ultramax, or black and white. Mm-hmm. A lot of Kodak, which is good. And Kodak's great. Love Kodak. It's great. But I wanted to use Lomo 400. I wanted to go for a real high saturation look. And it was summertime. It was on the beach. So I wanted to get that kind of like hot look. And the Lomo 400 has these really vibrant reds and blues. It was super vibrant. So that's the look that I wanted out of this zine that I made. And it's part of a greater New York zine project that I have. I actually have two more New York zines that will come out, I think, later this year. Should come out later this year. So this was called One Day in Coney because it was literally just one day I spent in Coney. Mm-hmm. And I shot 5 rolls in the day. And it turned out to be one of the best street photography days of my life. One of the probably top 5 days, at least. I really had a great time. It was an amazing vibe. Super, super friendly on the street. Great characters, great situations. So always one of my like bucket list, checklist locations to shoot in my life. And I went and I did it. So it's kind of like this, this like document of proof. I conquered, I did it, check,
yeah.
Next, you know?
Awesome.
And yeah, so it's just kind of like, you know, checking the box of like things that I've, that I will be able to look back and say that I did, with my street photography, career. And, you know, next for New York is more the Manhattan and Brooklyn. And that's going to be called Escape to New York. And that's going to be actually, I'm going to make it a double pack, zine. It's going to be a 2-for-1. And I thought I'm going to make, cause I don't want to milk it out too much, you know, like too much New York zines out there. Cause I don't want to make, you know, 3 separate releases. I thought, you know, I'm just going to make 2 New York zines in one pack called Escape to New York Part 1 and Part 2. One is in color and one is in black and white.
Oh, sounds great. Cool.
Yeah. Cause I didn't want to mix up the color and the black and white. It's a little bit jarring sometimes. Yeah. When you see a color photo and then next page is black and white and then back to color and then black and white again. So I just got, it's kind of messy. So I'm like, I'm going to make 1 zine for black and white and 1 for color and just separate that visually and conceptually really too as well, because the black and white photos that I'm going to have for New York have a different vibe, a different feel. And the color ones have a different vibe and feel. So yeah, so you can look out for that in the future. So the Coney Island one was really, One Day in Coney was like a warm up or like a prequel.
Yeah. Get you. Oh, what's a little bit sad. We're hyping up the listeners, in terms of One Day in Coney. And I've seen, it's sold out, unfortunately.
Yeah. Are you thinking, sold out.
Are you thinking about doing a second edition or something like that?
Yeah, sure. Actually, I think that I will try to print some more and do a triple pack.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So if people didn't get a chance to buy One Day in Coney, the first round, then when I do Escape to New York, then I'll have a double pack for Escape to New York and I'll have a triple pack for all 3.
Mm, cool.
And then people can get all 3 for a reduced price. You know, and pay one time for the shipping because the shipping costs, Jesus Christ.
That's a bummer. Yeah, totally.
Yeah, shipping is it's such a pain. But, you know, I try to make the shipping cost and the total cost make sense for people and ease it with just the one price and not try to make things confusing and difficult. So, so look out for that in the future.
Yeah, you'll definitely have 1 buyer from Germany at least. This will be me. I'm totally interested. Thanks. And I'm really sad that it's... I'm happy for you that it's sold out, but unfortunately, no one for me.
Yeah, I'm completely fortunate, blessed, really, that One Day in Coney sold out in a week. I sold 100 in a week.
Nice.
That was just like... I'm just so, so thankful and you know... blessed to have people buy my work, my very first zine that was. And then this previous book with Samuel, Hello, Goodbye Kyushu. Hello, mm-hmm. Kyushu, Goodbye Kyushu. We sold out of that as well in a week, 200 copies, in 1 week. And so it's just like super amazing that, I can take photos and I can then put it in a book on paper and sell it. So, it's an amazing feeling to just like get my work out to people and in their hands. And then they, you know, take a picture of it, send it to me. And I got it, you know, and they got their package and everything arrived okay, you know, and didn't get lost in the mail and this and that. Sure. And yeah, everything just works out. It's amazing, really.
Incredible. Alex, your Instagram bio says, stay humble. Is this approach you're trying in every kinds of life?
Yeah, definitely. Stay humble, right? So that can mean many things. And yeah. For photography and for me and my approach, staying humble means being true to oneself in your capabilities as a photographer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
How like realistically realistically important you are as a photographer. I don't want to be arrogant as a photographer. I don't want to be a show off. I like to have fun. I like to joke around. I like to, you know, be myself, with other people, you know, in private, in public, on YouTube, this and that kind of stuff. But at the same time, I'm not going to try to be arrogant about myself. You know what I mean? I want to go out and I want to do my thing. I want to enjoy myself as myself and be who I am and not be fake. Right. So that's what being humble is like checking myself, keeping myself in check, to not be, egotistical, you know, about my work. Cause if I get to a point in the future where it's like, I can actually be famous. I don't really consider myself famous, you know, like I consider myself like known, maybe well known, but famous. Like if I can become famous in the future, really famous photographer, I want to make sure that I'm humble about it always. And I'm not, you know, talking down to anyone, who's trying to make it as well, in photography. We all have struggles and we're all trying to express ourselves with photography and, hopefully sell our work too. That'd be nice, right?
Yeah, sure.
So I think we all have the same goals. And I just want to make sure that I'm checking myself before I wreck myself. You know what I mean?
Those are incredible words for letting this episode slowly come to an end. It was incredible. But before we come to an end, I would love to get in our picks category, which I informed you before getting here into the show.
I would
love to ask you, do you have a pick prepared?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. So, as we mentioned, my one day in Kony zine is sold out. The Hello Goodbye Kyushu book is sold out. However, I think it's really important to support photographers that not only that you like and respect and you want to let other people know about, but photographers that you personally know, photographers that you are friends with, and you should be able to promote your other photographer friends, and their work that they have out on print form, you know, in a book or zine or whatever. So my pick is Tokyo Unseen by Lucas Palka. And Lucas has his own YouTube channel, and which is far bigger than mine. And he's actually done some, you know, collab videos with Samuel as well. So Lucas has a book that I think came out a few months ago or a month ago, not too long ago. And he was fortunate and blessed enough to get a publisher from, I believe, Italy or Spain. He got a publisher to make a book for him. So he's got a book that's available. If you go to Lucas Palka, he's a fellow American, Polish American, from Chicago, living here in Tokyo with me. And, we did an exhibition together last month. Him and some other photographers, we all did an exhibition, and his book was available for sale there at the exhibition, and we traded books. So he gave me his book, I gave him my book, we signed each other's books, and he still has many of his books available because he has a publisher. He doesn't have to self-publish. So he should have plenty of books available to buy if anyone's interested in his book. His style is very flashy, very neon, very cool. He shoots digital, and he uses it in a very artistic way, which I think is how digital should be used, in a very artistic way. So it's a cool book. It's called Tokyo Unseen. Again, Tokyo Unseen. You can go to him, Lukas Palka. His name is spelled Lukasz Palka, Palka.
We definitely will put those links in the show notes. And I already found it on Amazon DE. So,
cool.
I've seen it and I immediately bought it in this second because it's
awesome.
Great. Because it's great.
Good.
And
it is a really good book.
Yeah, incredible.
It's a really good book. It's a really, really cool, good book. And I hope to get a publisher one day as well, because
hopefully
doing all of the work to make a book and then ship it and transactions and all this stuff. So much work.
It's incredible. That would be great. And now I've seen on the last page at Amazon, he has done multiple variations of that book. He has Tokyo Unseen, New York Unseen, Berlin Unseen, and London Unseen.
City. Yes. I think I know that he did New York. I didn't know he did Berlin too.
He did Berlin. So maybe if you're more the Berlin guy, you can also buy that too.
Cool.
Incredible. Good. Perfect.
Yes.
I have a little tool. I'm not sure if it's available on Windows as well, but I'm sure it's available on the Mac. And this thing is called Image Optim, which is basically a small little tool which makes your JPEGs much, much smaller than they are actually. So if I'm going to, I told you about my process, I got big TIFF files with approximately 130 megabytes. After I converted them to JPEGs and exported them from Lightroom, they're still pretty big with about 30 megabytes. And if I want to share them with you people out there, I've got to convert them and make them a little bit smaller. And Image Optim is a free open source solution as far as I'm aware. And it's great. It's perfect. Cool. You can drag and drop a lot of images into it. Your computer is getting probably a little bit hot because it's tackling everything in that little box. And after that, your images are way smaller and easier to share with the world.
Nice.
Right. Perfect. This, Alex, makes this show come to an end.
Thank you so much.
It was totally
Thank you for doing it in English.
Yeah, obviously. Cool. Sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
No problem.
And thank you for your German listeners for having to listen to me.
That's
and
perfect.
Us in English. So thank you very much.
That's perfect. It was a pleasure to have you. And now I'm going to play our outro. And thank you again. And hopefully we will see each other on Instagram or any other platform.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye.